Let me begin first by reminding everybody that if there are a whole bunch of people who haven't picked up their exams yet, and you those people should pick them up in my office during office hours tomorrow, which are from 3 to 5 tomorrow. So that's one thing. The other thing is about the overall grading for the course. As you know, there are three components to the grade. The two in-class exams plus the take-home part of the final exam. And in general, they'll carry approximately equal weight. The one exception to that has to do with the people who get a grade of F on one of those three parts of the exam. And in those cases, what I'll do is I'll kind of review the overall record to see what the final grade should be. And in doing that, overall, you know, to see, basically to see whether, you know, that particular person deserves to get a passing grade for the course. And in doing that review, I'll pay special attention to whether there's been improvement from the midterm to the final. So it won't just be a strict arithmetical thing. So, okay. Yeah? No, it's dinner. I think I described it in the syllabus. It's basically going to be about challenging you to figure out what you've learned in the course of the quarter means, what its implications are, especially in terms of policy. In other words, it's just an exercise designed you to draw meaning from all the work you've done in the course of the quarter to kind of grapple with these kind of core issues about how foreign policy should be conducted and so on. But it's fairly straightforward. It's the main goal there is not so much to assess your performance in the course, but to give you a chance to pull things together for yourself. Okay. Yeah? How many pages would the take-home be? I don't know. Did I say anything on the syllabus? I don't. No, not terribly long, around 8 to 10 pages, right? It's what? What is that? You don't want. You think what? 8 to 10. What did you? I can't hear you. An eight to ten page take home you consider a lot? No. I mean, what do you think? It should be 2 pages to kind of pull together what you've learned in the course of the quarter? No. Come on. Yeah. Well, then start preparing it for now. I mean, it's you know, start, you know, going over your notes. You have the entire quarter to... What you've learned about policy from all the stuff that we've done. I mean, what I did last year, I don't know if I'm going to do it again, but I had this whole thing of... pretend that the President of the United States has called you up on the phone and said, you know, we really have to rethink American policy from the ground up. I've heard you taking this course at UCLA. What have you learned from that course that could help me with the conduct of foreign policy? In other words, it's not anything that calls for a huge amount of work on your part. It's like what you yourself have taken away from this course. You know, you support it with references to what you've learned about the origins of the Second World War, the origins of the war in the Pacific, the Cold War, and so on. You know, It's just the question of, think of it this way. In the course of the quarter, it's as though you've been nurturing a kind of a fruit tree, right? You've been, watering the fruit tree and so on. And finally, by the end of the quarter, the fruit on the fruit tree is ripe. And then what you want to do is just kind of pluck the fruit. Pluck the fruit. It shouldn't be all that hard if you've been doing this work. And, one of the ways you could go about doing that is at the end of each lecture, sit down and write a few lines about, what do I take away from this lecture about these kind of core issues about how policy should be conducted. Are there general principles that should guide the conduct of policy? Let me just say this. It's a sort of thing, there are no hard and fast answers to these issues. Different people, intelligent people, have different takes on these questions. All we want is some evidence that you thought seriously about this stuff. And, that's the goal of that particular exercise and that assignment. So if you feel like, you have a lot of other exams that week, start preparing for it now. No one says you can't start, taking notes about this stuff now. You had a question?
Yeah, are you going to actually give us a problem?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
What did I? Didn't I say in the in the syllabus? I'm sorry. I should have reread the syllabus before. I didn't know people were going to ask you all these questions today. But normally it would be, in the last week of the quarter, I'll give out the prompt, and it's something you should want to do, because it's like challenges you intellectually. Again, remember what I said at the beginning of the quarter. You just think about the structure of a class like this, with me just spouting off all this stuff here, and you just passively taking down notes. That's not real learning. Real learning has to be much more active than that. You have to kind of, challenge your brain and try and grapple with these issues for yourself. And this is just an exercise designed to provide you with a framework for doing this sort of thing. It's like, yeah? Okay, all right. That's fine. Okay, it's like I'll do that this week. I'll promise you that. That's fine. That's fine. In that case, no one has any objection to this 8-to-10-page business, right? All right, good. So we've reached an understanding. Yeah. That's okay. I promise you, that's the lecture today, right? That's the lecture today. See, what I wanted to do last time is to say, look, they finally worked out something. That, this could have worked. This really could have worked because it solved, the problem of defense against the Soviet Union with a strong NATO system. It solved the problem of people worried about Germany because Germany was contained in all of this. It really could have worked. And then, okay, so what happened, right? It's the same sort of thing that we did for 1945 and for 1949. This is the third time that we bring this thing into focus. But I promise you, I'll talk about this today. That's okay. That's okay. It's good. It's good that you kind of outrunning me a little bit, because that means your mind is prepared to kind of take in what I'm going to be talking about today. Yeah. Outside sources? Can you use outside sources? Yes. You can use whatever you want. I'm sorry? You don't have... I'm not even going to ask you to have citations. It's a take-home exam. In take-home exams, it's not a term paper, right? It's not a research paper or anything like that where you have to cite things. It's just, tell me what all this stuff means. right? Or tell the president, or however. Or you like the whole thing about advising the president? All right, we'll do something like that. Kind of a memo to the president. We'll do that. Yeah. You say theoretical, kind of conceptual, big issues, fundamental principles. Was Hillary Clinton right to castigate the Syrian government for having a sham election? I'm not interested in stuff like that. Obviously, this stuff overlaps. You look at what's in the news today, and you're coming at it with a certain sense for what policy should be, what's wrong with American foreign policy. But you don't have to talk about that stuff in the paper. It's the big stuff, the big issues. Are there basic principles that should guide the conduct of foreign policy? Not just for the country like the United States, but in general. If your concern is with a stable international system, is there anything you could say about what, in general, should guide states when they're grappling with these fundamental issues of foreign policy? So, big stuff like that. And, I'll just say this, because part of the problem with the conduct of policy is people think, we'll just deal with these specific problems on their own terms. We won't get involved with all this theory, because theory is just this kind of academic enterprise that's unrelated to the actual conduct of foreign policy. So that's a terribly mistaken way of approaching these things. You cannot think in any meaningful way about any specific foreign policy issue without bringing assumptions of a theoretical nature into play. And that goes for whether you're dealing with like the Libyan problem, the Syrian problem, the Iranian problem, any of those things. They're based on assumptions of a theoretical nature. But you don't have to talk about topical stuff by any means. Okay, anything else before I actually give the lecture that's an answer to her question? So where are we? We're concerned with this basic issue of, all these basic issues of the Cold War. What was the Cold War about? And why did it eventually evolve into a relatively stable international system where the threat of a third world war kind of receded very dramatically? And those two questions are interrelated, because you can't figure out why a stable system eventually took shape until you figure out what the fundamental problems were that lay at the heart of the Cold War, right? Because it's only by resolving those problems that you can have a relatively peaceful international order. So you want to figure out what those problems were. And so a lot of the argument was that these European questions, these German questions, lay at the heart of the Cold War. Why was Western Europe so important? Because of the war-making resources, the military-industrial base that existed in that region. Who dominated that region would have a huge bearing on what the global balance of power was, and therefore on the security of all the major states. And there was a rough solution to that question of what the fate of Europe and the fate of Germany would be. It was the division of Europe and the division of Germany. Each side would run things in its part of Germany, in its part of Europe. And that, on that basis, you'd think the two sides could get along in peace. The problem was that there was one great exception to that general rule about how the two sides could coexist, and that had to do with West Germany, Western Germany, three Western zones. Because there was a limit to how much of a free hand for the Western powers the Soviets would tolerate with regard to Western Germany. If the Western powers pursued a strategy of building up West Germany, giving it too much sovereignty, too much independence, too much freedom of action, allowing it to develop too much in the way of military power, well, that was something that the Soviets would find very hard to accept for essentially defensive purposes. Right? This is where these security dilemma notions come into play. The Soviets had a strong interest on going on the offensive, what you may think, pursuing an aggressive strategy vis-a-vis Western Germany, insisting on some say over what happened in Western Germany. The meaning of Soviet policy during the Berlin blockade, for example, in 48, had nothing to do, really, with Berlin proper. It was all about what the Western powers were doing in Western Germany. You know, this is a policy that was pursued for purely, essentially defensive purposes. Similarly, what the West was doing in terms of building up West Germany, restoring political rights to the Germans, integrating West Germany into the Western system, doing all these things that the West knew the Soviets would find very distasteful, this was pursued for essentially defensive reasons. The West had to, ease up on the controls on German power in order to get the Germans to throw in their lot with the West, and German participation in the Western defense system was an essential condition for the construction of a viable power bloc that could serve as a counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. You needed the Germans to be on your side in order to hold the Soviets at bay. So a lot of what the West was doing vis-a-vis West Germany is, again, to be understood in essentially defensive terms. Right? So we looked at these various points when it seemed that a solution to that fundamental question, the question of German power, was in the cards. That way of analyzing things directs our attention to a number of specific points in time when it seemed that the world was on the verge of a relatively peaceful system, when a set of arrangements was coming into being that everyone pretty much could live with. Because if you have a political understanding of that sort, there's no risk of war. Wars come about because of political clashes, not because of the workings of the military system. And so our focus has to be on whether the basis for a political understanding, political accommodation exists. So we looked at 1945 and the kind of informal understanding, secret understanding that Burns and Stalin reached Potsdam, and we tried to understand why that failed. Then we looked at 1949, much more open, formal division of Europe into spheres of influence. It seemed the Soviets had accepted it when they agreed to suspend the Berlin blockade in the spring of 1949, accept the coming into being of the Federal Republic of Germany and the whole North Atlantic Treaty and so on. And that failed. A year later, the world moves into this big crisis. And then we looked... We began looking at the third time when it seemed that the world was on the verge of a relatively peaceful system, that this set of problems, it seemed, was on the verge of being resolved. And this is the signing of the Paris Accords in October of 1954. Paris Accords, probably never heard of the Paris Accords before you took this course, but they're extremely important. This is the heart of the Western system, the great settlement between West Germany and the three Western powers. It seemed that the Paris Accords, the 1954 Paris Accords, would lay the basis for a stable international order. And why was this? Because it solved the problem of security for Western Europe in general and for West Germany in particular, security against the Soviet threat by bringing the Americans in, by basing the security of Western Europe on a defense setup that was the heart of which was American power, the American troop presence, the fact that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization had an American general as its commander called SACEUR, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, just a very common acronym in those days.
But Germany would not be a threat. You saw, why would Germany not be a threat? Because there are limits on German power. Germany was not supposed to develop nuclear weapons. German forces were integrated in the NATO system. Germany was contained within a structure dominated by American power, right? And the fact that German power was limited meant that the Soviets could be reassured. This is a source of security for the Soviets. The Soviets were not worried about the United States or Britain, France. Those countries were perfectly happy to live with a divided Europe. Not so for Germany. Right? And as long as German power was limited, West Germany would be dependent on the Western powers for protection, and therefore West Germany would be obliged to pull in her horns and pursue an essentially status quo-oriented policy. That's the most the Soviets could hope for. Soviet interests are accommodated. You could think of this in security dilemma terms. Right? It's the American presence that blunts the sharp edge of the security dilemma, because it means that both the Soviet Union and West Germany could be secure at the same time. They could be secure without posing too great a threat to the other. The Soviet threat would be limited. The German threat would also be limited. And the American presence there would be like a cushion between Germany and Russia. Right? Solves in large measure the security dilemma. You can think of it in those terms as well. Right? And so you look at this and you say, this could have worked. This could have worked. What went wrong? We know that things went wrong because just a few years later, November of 1958, a very serious crisis breaks out. The Berlin crisis that lasts, you know, with its ups and downs, you know, for 4 years. It's only solved in October of 1962. The Cuban Missile Crisis is the climactic event in the Berlin crisis. It's part and parcel of it, as we'll see. So we have to try and figure out why it was that the system of the Paris Accords, the November 1954 system, didn't work, that it didn't provide the basis for a stable international order. And so we looked at the end of the lecture last time at the policies of the three major powers that could have had, that were crucial to determining whether this system would be viable or not. You know, we looked at Soviet policy. Would they go along with it? Yeah, pretty much, if they could believe in it. Why? Because it solved their number one security problem in Europe, the control of German, meaning West German, power. Right? The Germans themselves, could they go along with it? Well, yeah, even though it was harsher than Versailles, remember. These limits on German sovereignty were more extreme than anything that had been imposed on Germany at Versailles. But still, they could go along with it for a variety of reasons. The main one was that it provided the NATO system, a system based on an American military presence in the heart of Europe. The NATO system could provide West Germany with a substantial degree of security, protection against the Soviet threat. And it was attractive in all kinds of other ways, because it implied the political and moral rehabilitation of West Germany, that they were being accepted back into the Western community as a civilized state, standing shoulder to shoulder with the other Western powers in the defense of Western civilization. All those things were enormously important. It was tied to all these notions of the building of Europe, meaning the building of a continental West European political entity, a Western Europe embodying the fundamental values of West European civilization that could stand on its own, right? And this had an enormous appeal in Germany as an alternative to the old discredited German nationalism of the past. There were all kinds of reasons why, on balance, and there were lots of things about this system that a lot of people in Germany didn't like, on balance, this was something that the Germans could accept.
the real fly in the ointment had to do not with Soviet policy or with German policy, as you might expect, but with American policy. This is what's so extraordinary about this story. It's of the policy of the U.S. government. Policy of the president who came to power in January of 1953, Dwight Eisenhower, remained in power for 8 years until January of 61. He pursued a policy that was inconsistent with the basic philosophy of the Paris Accords. The Paris Accords were based, it's the NATO system based on a permanent American military presence in Europe. American troops, an American general as the NATO commander, all those kinds of things. The Atlantic system, a system that was based on the notion of an organic link between North America and Western Europe. This was not something that Eisenhower supported. Eisenhower did not want a permanent American military presence in Europe. You know, think about it. The whole NATO system, it's not something that the United States necessarily likes because it means the Americans are the top dog and it's kind of like this American empire and the Americans are throwing their weight around in this really important part of the world. The American military presence in Europe is a liability for the United States. It means that if push comes to shove over Berlin or over some German question, and matters escalate up to the level of the Third World War, well, American cities are at risk. Especially if we can't provide an effective non-nuclear defense of Western Europe. And the only way of defending Western Europe is through taking the lead through nuclear escalation. The other side is bound to respond in kind. If we attack them, they're certainly going to attack us if they can. And so a policy of providing an American military guarantee, an American security guarantee for Western Europe, means that our own necks are on the chopping block. It's like not the most attractive strategy in the long run. If, you know, nowadays, you know, for most of the Cold War, people just took it as normal, as a fact of life. But in the early days of the Cold War, people were grappling with these issues. Is this what we really want? And Eisenhower didn't like the idea of a permanent American military presence in Europe, of America as the kind of top dog calling the shots. It's not the sort of world he wanted. America, in his view, was just not cut out for the imperial role. He didn't want to be a modern Rome, as he said, with America guarding the far-flung reaches of its empire. And this is especially true since the Europeans were, in principle, perfectly capable of providing for their own defense. You look at the mass of industrial resources concentrated in Western Europe, technological resources, human resources, size of their population, size of their economy. The West Europeans were perfectly capable of building enough defensive power to keep the Soviets at bay. Right? And they should do it. They should provide for their own defense. You know, any self-respecting country would want to provide for its own defense and not be totally dependent on foreigners, especially foreigners based, an ocean away. The Europeans should want to do this. All they had to do was kind of come together and put their silly national, you know, traditions aside, which no longer made sense in the nuclear age. The West Europeans should merge themselves into a bloc, into a true United States of Europe. And when they did that, the resources they controlled were such that they could certainly generate enough power to hold their own, to defend themselves against the Soviets. Right? That's the Eisenhower philosophy. It's kind of like there's a moral element to that philosophy. See? It's like, it's wrong to infantilize the Europeans. It's wrong for them to be so dependent on a foreign power that they can't stand on their own 2 feet. You know, we want to be friends with them. We want to maintain the alliance. But we want them to kind of pursue a self-respecting policy, providing, in the first instance, for their own defense. Right? And I mean, to me, this is a big surprise when I started going through the documents and seeing this as like the main theme of Eisenhower. You know, the whole Eisenhower's idea was Europe should become a third great power mass in world affairs, a third great pool of power, strong enough to say no to both the Soviets and the Americans. They should stand on their own. And when that happened, then the United States, they said, can sit back and relax somewhat. So we wouldn't have to carry this enormous burden of providing for the defense of Europe. Right? They're strong enough to do it themselves. They should do it themselves. And so that was the basic Eisenhower strategy. Europe is a third great power mass in world affairs. Yeah? Well, it's like, I didn't say that necessarily didn't think the U.S. would go along. I'm saying that their assumption was, if this thing were viable, it would be perfectly satisfactory. Right? From the start, both sides had their doubts about whether the U.S. would go along. You know, don't forget, the whole image of the United States in the world is that it's a very, very powerful country, but a little weak in the upstairs, you know? It's like they don't understand. Well, and those two things go together, because when you're so strong, you don't have an incentive to, develop a really well-thought-out strategy, because your power just gives you so much room for error that you can just, pursue these kind of ideological policies and so on. We saw this when we compared the French and the Americans in the period of the First World War. It's not like the Europeans are morally superior or smarter inherently, but the incentives are very different. So foreigners, including the Soviets and the Germans, they look at the Americans, they say, they're very strong, but they're kind of like children. They don't really think closely in these parapolitical terms the way they should, and all right, so people, they had their doubts about this from the start. Analytically, that doesn't matter, because analytically what matters is their assumption, or their assumption, that if the United States was willing to go along with this, if the system of the Paris Accords turned out to be viable, that would be okay, we could live with that, right? No other question. Okay. So you have this Eisenhower strategy, a third great power mass in world affairs, implying that the Europeans should build up their power. The Europeans should stand on their own. Soviet Union is a nuclear power. The only way a country can stand up, or a group of countries could stand up to a great nuclear power like the USSR, is by developing its own nuclear forces, by building a nuclear capability under its own political control, not under the control of foreigners. Right? No problem for Eisenhower. He was in favor of the Europeans, especially as a bloc, on an integrated basis. He was in favor of the Europeans developing a nuclear capability, because that was the only way in which Europe could become a third great power mass. And when the Europeans did that, when European power was built up in that direction, then the Americans could pull out. You can't pull out until it happens. You don't want to create a vacuum that would tempt the Soviets to move in before it was too late. So you'd have to stay while this process was running its course, while the Europeans were coming together, politically and militarily, building up their power, developing common institutions that would enable a united Europe to mobilize all the resources of Western Europe, instead of divided between all these little national states that were antiquated, right? You would have to stay in while the process was running its course, but gradually you would want to pull out. You would want NATO, for example, as the American presence in Europe diminished, you know, down to like maybe just the single division, maybe even down to zero, you want NATO to devolve into a European defense organization. And that the American general who is SACUR, the NATO commander, this would become a European general. Eisenhower basically thought it should be a French general who should replace the Americans as SACUR. Right? So that's the, you know, the fundamental Eisenhower concept. You see how it contradicts the basic theory of the Paris Accords. You're removing the American factor from Europe. And that inevitably sharpens the security dilemma between Germany and Russia. Right? Because if the Americans go, then you and the Europeans have to stand on their own. That means building up their strength, and in particular means building up nuclear capability, means bringing the Germans closer to having their finger on the nuclear trigger. That's a basic Soviet concern. Too strong a Germany. So, and if the Americans are leaving, the Europeans pretty much have to go that route. If the Americans aren't going to protect them, they're going to have to protect themselves. You know, when you talk in those terms, it sounds really nice. You know, Eisenhower, he wasn't interested in Imperial America. He wanted the Europeans to provide for their own defense, to stand on their own two feet. You know, he was a big supporter of European unification and all these steps that were taken in the early 1950s. That pointed toward the unification of Europe. The Schuman plan for a coal and steel community of 1950 was the first big thing. There was this whole plan for the European defense community. This is from December of 1950 until August of 1954. And then the plans for the common market, the plans especially for a European atomic energy community called Euratom. The Americans are big supporters of all of this stuff because they point toward Europe kind of coming together. And even if it's kind of coming together in all these kind of functional areas, still the notion is ultimately they're going to have to create political institutions to kind of govern what they're doing in the area of coal and steel or running the common market or in the area of atomic energy and so on. Ultimately, the Europeans are going to have to come together politically, and that's what the Americans want. Right? So your heart, kind of, you know, at a certain level, your heart goes out to the Eisenhower. It's like, yeah, these are the right values. Right? We want allies that we can respect, allies who take charge of their own destiny, who are not infantilized, who provide for their own defense. The problem is that strategy that you could kind of sympathize with in many ways puts East and West on a collision course because it implies the nuclearization of Germany. That's the Soviets' number one concern in Europe. They have to kind of respond to it. They have this very effective lever for responding to it, namely the Allied presence in West Berlin, which is the Allies' Achilles heel. That we'll see is the origin of the Berlin crisis of November 58. The crisis that begins in November 58, the central episode of the Cold War. I'm going to be talking about it in very great detail, not today, but in a further lecture. Okay. Now that's the heart of what's going on. But there are other elements to the Eisenhower strategy that fit into all of this. You see, what we're trying to understand is the failure of the 54 system. 54 system is based on the American presence and on the limitations on German power. The key limitation on German power is in the nuclear area. And yet we're trying to understand the Eisenhower strategy was pushing the opposite direction, ultimately countenancing the buildup of nuclear power by the European allies, and in particular by West Germany. So that's what we want to understand. The basic concept that underlies all of this is this Eisenhower strategy about Europe being a third great power mass in world affairs. The Europeans should defend themselves. The Americans should pull out, and so on. But that's not the end of the story, because there are two other important elements in this that I want to kind of at least begin to talk about today. I don't think I'll make it through, though. The first is what was called MC48. This is one of those things. I would bet that not a single person in this class heard about MC48 before you started taking this class. And yet it's extremely important, far more important than a lot of things that were on the front pages of the New York Times in those days, like the Hungarian Revolution, things like that, which I don't even talk about because they're just surface episodes of no great political meaning. MC48 is of fundamental importance. This is the strategy for the defense of Europe that was adopted by the NATO Council in December of 1954, just a few months after the Paris Accords. MC48, an extremely important document, because it laid down the strategy for the defense of Europe for the next few years, certainly. What was the story here? Well, there had been this huge buildup of American military power during the period of the Korean War, during the late Truman period, I should say, the period from December of 1950 to late 1952. By late 1952, American power had been built up to just absolutely extraordinary levels. What the Soviets had, all this World War II vintage equipment, kind of largely antiquated. Americans much more technologically advanced, much stronger, especially in the nuclear sphere, in the area of air power. If war had broken out, the Soviet Union would have been utterly obliterated, and the United States would have gotten off pretty much scot-free, maybe even the Western Europeans as well. I mean, this is very much the upper hand in military terms, this thing. The question was, how do you take advantage of this operationally? How do you take advantage of this huge level of military power that had resulted from the Truman buildup, and which Eisenhower inherited, when he took office? From Eisenhower's point of view, you needed to make changes in NATO strategy. The existing NATO strategy, the strategy that had been adopted by Eisenhower's successor, Sacheverell, during the late Truman period, was the Ridgway strategy. General Matthew Ridgway had been appointed by Truman as the Sacheverell. Ridgway was just a very conventional person. For him, yeah, there would be this strategic air campaign that was being conducted with these bombers, U.S. Air Force bombers based in the continental United States that were to be attacking targets in the Soviet Union. But that was essentially a separate war. He was planning for the European conflict, for a European war, just war in the theater. And the whole Ridgway concept didn't take into account what the U.S. Strategic Air Command, which is delivering the air atomic offensive, was doing. And Eisenhower just thought this was crazy. It was like much too hidebound, much too conservative. So practically, as soon as he comes in, he does these kind of remarkable things to put his own imprint on American military strategy. Basically, he fires the entire Joint Chiefs of Staff that he had inherited from Truman. Very unusual in American history. Gets rid of them all. And then what he does is he pulls Ridgway back from Europe and makes him Army Chief of Staff. And then the other members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, He appoints people who take a much more pro-nuclear line. Not conservative the way Ridgway was, but people thought that American military power was essentially nuclear power. The strategic air offensive was the heart of American power. We should rely on that to a quite extraordinary degree, which is more extreme than Eisenhower's own view. But what this meant was that the JCS was divided between Ridgway, who was conservative, and these kind of people put much heavier emphasis on strategic air operations than Ridgeway. So Eisenhower is the arbiter of a divided JCS. And then, by pulling Ridgeway back from Europe, he had created a vacancy at NATO headquarters. And what he did was he replaced Ridgeway with his closest friend, General Alfred Grunther, who had been Eisenhower's chief of staff when Eisenhower had been SACEUR in 1951. And he made Grunther the new SACEUR. And Grunther now, with Eisenhower's full support in the background, stage manages this process that leads to the junking of the Ridgeway strategy and its replacement by this new strategy called MC-48. Now, what was MC-48? It was a strategy not just of deterrence, of making nuclear threats that might be suicidal to us if they were actually implemented. It was a strategy for the actual defense of Europe. Europe, in the view of people like Grunther, could be defended in one and only one way. And that was by the massive, concentrated, and above all, extremely rapid use of nuclear weapons, both strategically and in the theater. Okay? Strategically means, as soon as you've thought the war is inevitable, you're going to launch this massive attack and utterly destroy the whole Soviet, the basis of Soviet war-making power, the whole Soviet military-industrial complex, especially their nuclear complex, their aircraft production facilities, their existing air bases, and so on. Just wipe it out. But while the sources of Soviet military power, you know, were being destroyed, and while Soviet power in the field would still be in existence, so you had to worry about the defense of NATO Europe during this relatively brief period, while the Soviets still had forces in being in Western Europe. But before those forces would wither on the vine because you were destroying the Soviet military-industrial structure within the USSR. Well, actually, I'm out of time now, so let me just end the lecture here, and we'll begin with a further discussion of MC-48, both what its meaning was and what the implications were in the lecture next time.